Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We're talking about food. We're talking about music. And musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. Darren Bresnitz is still out on his, we'll say hiatus, but you know, normally we just call it a job. That was just Freelance Wales, who will be in studio live. And I think the last time we had them on here was like 2.5 years ago. They were one of the first bands that we had to come and bring in a full setup. So I'm incredibly excited to have them come and be part of this. But first off, I want to welcome to the studio, Tiki Adam.
Hey there.
Who is not here to talk about tiki drinks.
I am not, sir.
Although you have been on, which other program were you on?
Of course, Damon Bolte's program.
Yeah.
Oh, man, what's it? It's...
The Speakeasy.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And you can check that out on the Heritage Radio Network archives. But we are here today to talk about the Brooklyn Feeding Academy, which is kind of mind-blowing to me. Darren, you know, was going over this week's guest with me, and I had never heard about this or the ideas practiced here. But so let's kind of start from the beginning. What is the Brooklyn Feeding Academy, and what do you teach?
Okay, the Brooklyn Feeding Academy is actually a therapeutic practice devoted to helping kids and their approach to food. There's a whole segment of the population that I work with that have issues related to eating. And I have a clinical, my clinical practice for the last 20 years is specialized in pediatric feeding and swallowing disorders.
And let's talk about the difference, you know, let's say between a picky eater, which, you know, almost everyone probably is, to someone that has a, you know, a disorder. What is the main difference there?
Okay, so as a speech-language pathologist specializing in this area of practice, oftentimes it's fairly common for toddlers, for young kids, to exhibit picky eating behavior. That's that kind of is part and parcel to their emerging autonomy as human beings. So you certainly have a choice over what it is you like, what you don't like. And that phase of development generally passes by 2 into 3 years of age. The kids that I deal with don't eat because they don't want to. They have issues with food because they can't chew it, or they have what we call sensory disorders related to the texture of food in their mouths. And when you have difficulty chewing and you have difficulty with perceiving the sensation of food in your mouth, you're going to register those foods as threats. And as threats, you eliminate those foods from your diet.
Give us an extreme example of like why this is an issue and how bad this can get and what it does to the child.
Okay. And it's a good question because it's never solely the child. The whole it becomes an entire family dynamic around what this kid will or will not eat. And in my extreme cases, which are the kids that fall into the autistic spectrum disorder, we're talking about kids that are subsisting on 2, maybe 3 foods, period. And one of those foods is typically dairy. So they'll have a huge over-reliance on milk. And then they might eat a certain brand of white bread. And they're subsisting on those two issues. And that's my extreme case. And then, of course, the family has to adapt to try to meet this child's needs.
So, like, what is the... And they're adapting why? Like, what is the reaction that the child has when they're given something that they just are, you know, reject?
Okay, so the family desperately tries to stand on their head, to do anything, like toys, bribes, videos on the table, in order to engage this kid with the food. And whenever the child is offered something outside their regard of food, they can tantrum, they can throw food, they can throw themselves to the ground. They'll do anything to escape that which they perceive as a threat. So it's very extreme, and it's hard for folks, especially, you know, in this community that love food, to really identify with looking at food as a potential threat. So it can get very extreme. And like I say, parents don't plan on having children with eating issues. And so you find yourself down this rabbit hole of all these ridiculous accommodations, not ridiculous in the context of you and your child, but ridiculous to the outside.
Right. The second you tell someone like, oh yeah, my kid only eats string cheese and Wonder Bread, they're like, oh, you're a terrible parent.
That's so true. And you bring up a very good point again in that the fitness of parents is very often at the basest level judged on how well you're able to nourish your child. And so it really, really gets to the very core of us as a humanity in terms of the, you know, propagation and nourishing of the species even. So yes, the in-laws And the well-meaning folks always have the remedy of, you know, and even the pediatric establishment, the remedy there is if you prevent them, if you withhold the food, if you let them starve, they will eventually eat. And the kids I deal with will starve. And in fact, 150 years ago, this disorder isn't a new disorder. It's always existed in humankind, but these kids were failure to thrive. They became immunocompromised and they perished.
So the obvious question I think to me and listeners now is like, where are the threats coming from? How are these developed and how do they grow over time?
Okay, so that's you're spot on with your questions here. The threat is inborn. I shouldn't say the threat. The conditions that set up the threat are inborn. In that, we have a child born with a small motor incapacity to move the muscles and coordinate the teeth, jaw, and tongue to chew. Now, feeding is reflexive in the first 4 months of life. So we're born, we suck from the nipple, all our nutrition is liquid, no problem. It's a reflexive issue. Then, about 6 to 9 months, then we start to be introduced purees. Again, very easy to manage. This problem almost universally manifests itself from 7 to 9 months of age, where the child is then required or offered mixed texture foods. So we're talking about stews and things that are overcooked and mushy. But the child's motor apparatus and or, it's always a combination of the two, or very typically the combination, or their sensory apparatus in their mouths perceive this as a threat. They might have a small choking incident. They're having difficulty transitioning from puree to mixed texture foods.
And what is triggering that perception? Is it just inborn?
Well, what it is that they're unsuccessful at managing these textures. So they may chew too long, there may be a great deal of effort, or in the sensory capacity, it would be like the best analogy I can give you is when you're having a slice of pizza and you have something inappropriately crunchy. Okay, and you know how that...
For me, it's watercress in Chinese food. Okay, hate the texture.
Right, and that's another aspect of this. But the panic that comes over the introduction of a texture that doesn't belong in a food...
Okay, I see.
You immediately expel that food because it may be a piece of glass, and the perception of it in your mouth is much greater than the actual tiny shard of whatever that might be.
Right.
This is the daily life of these kids.
So does it now just could it be that one day when you're, 18 months, mom is supposed to make carrots, she undercooks them and they're more crunchy than mushy and it could start there? Or is it even more just innate where you just can't transition to dealing with just certain textures on a total primal instinctual level?
That's absolutely right. It's the latter. Because you and I and folks with normal sensory motor functioning adapt.
Right.
And we may not be crazy about it, but it's not going to cause a panic reaction. When you have near choking and difficulty, maybe even breathing or this sensory issue, those foods at that very early level are registered as threats. And at that point, we as human beings, or these kids specifically, stop learning about food. And eating and developing our tastes is all about sensory learning regarding food. But those foods are now off the table. And they're no longer even regarded as food per se because they're threats. And these kids become experts at being able to judge what they can and cannot eat or will not eat.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick musical break and we're going to talk about solutions or potential solutions.
There you go.
Or guidance to weary parents. First, we're going to play a track from Ultra Nouveau. Their new record is out in February. This track is called Warning off the new album called Anxiety. You're listening to Snacky Tunes. Stay tuned for Freelance Whales and more from Tiki Adam.
What's this thing that I can't explain? Just a feeling more like a warning. And this thing that I'm telling you I can't explain. Just a like a warning, oh no, it goes, I'm never
All right, Entre Nouveau. I mean, that song is so good. We are live with Tiki Adam from the Brooklyn Phenian Academy. So to kind of continue on about, you know, we just talked about, you know, the root of this and where it comes from, mm-hmm. you know, how does the Brooklyn Phenian Academy begin to offer solutions? And when, and no, it's not like you bring a kid in for a week, but like, where does it start?
Okay, it starts at just evaluating the kid in his home at the table during a typical meal so that I can kind of get a sense of all the maladaptations, the maladaptions, if you will, that the family has had to institute to get this child to eat. And then seeing what the root cause, what are the escapes from the food, what's his reaction to things on the plate, all that type of thing, you know, in the home. And that's real important. I've worked in a clinical setting where, you know, you try to evaluate these things in a laboratory, and it's really not as valid as really getting in and seeing what all the conditions are. So that's the first step is, and I'll observe, you know, if the kid's having difficulty at school, I'll look at school. So I look at as many different dining contexts as possible to get an overall picture of this kid's approach to food.
Okay. And then, you know, let's not take an extreme because those are obviously extreme. But sure. Let's take someone that, well, let me ask you this. Can someone be cured?
Yes.
Okay. So let's take someone that can be cured. And, you know, once the evaluation is done, what are the next steps? And how do you involve the family?
Okay. So then we institute, typically, I deal with all types of feeding issues, organic and generally what I deal with is organic. But what we'll do is, one of the approaches that I use is called the sequential oral sensory protocol, by where I sit down with the family and what we do is we construct a hierarchy of foods that include fruits and vegetables, proteins, starches, and then work across all the different textures. And so what we're doing basically is working with a parent at the dining table and reintroducing these foods that had been disregarded in the context of play, away from mealtime. And so what we're doing is we're building back a tolerance by just having the child explore the food the way that we all do when we get to know a food. And I'm also building the oral motor component necessary for chewing, as well as developing tolerance to the sensory aspect as well.
Can you give an example of, I mean, maybe conversion is not the right, relearning. Can you give
sure.
an example?
So in other words, if my guy has three or four different foods that he's willing to eat, and I've ascertained that he has a sensory motor issue related to that problem, then what we're doing is slowly working him up a sensory hierarchy from just being able to, I have kids that have literally vomited at the sight of the food in front of them. That's how strong their aversion is to this. So we basically move the food from far away to close, to touching it, to maybe putting it to the lips, on up through, so that sensory flight, if you will, is quelled a bit. Without the expectation that this kid's going to eat this food, what we do when we ask kids to eat the food right away is bypass a whole giant compendium of sensory learning that needs to take place before we can assume a food. The rule of thumb is, for any kid, is that they have to be exposed, research has proven this time and again, at least 10 times to a food before they'll consider it a food. Oftentimes, we want to rush kids into eating something, and they just can't do it. So this is a way that we can slowly build tolerance, build the skills necessary to eat the food, and then incorporate that specific food back into their diet a little at a time, with the goal of having at least 30 different foods in their arsenal at any given time.
Is age a factor? Like, if you get this at a younger age, they'll adapt more quickly, or is it irrelevant to the process?
No, it's totally relevant. The earlier I can get to a child, the better. I have some teenagers that I'm working with that are extremely limited, and with the, you know, the ongoing issue comes the whole phenomenon of creating the mythology around yourself not being a non-eater. I don't eat this because, and then you'll hear the myth behind it, and it becomes much more ingrained in the psyche, if you will, that I have a very defined rationale for why I don't eat X, Y, and Z.
Right. I mean, so this seems also like a family issue, and you know, also I would also feel like current trends probably play into this. You know, before when you know it was, I guess it's perceived, but you know, more time for family dinners, more time together. There seems like there would be a way for this to be group, like a kind of group learning experience. Like, how are modern day factors playing into this, these disorders? Is it, you know, are kids going unnoticed, or are they getting more noticed now because parents are just more aware of it?
Well, that's a good question, because like I was saying earlier, most of the pediatric orthodoxy kind of blows this whole thing off, in that these kids will oftentimes be appropriate height and weight, but they're suboptimally nourished. So they're not underweight kids. In fact, these kids are actually at risk for being obese because of their over-reliance on carbohydrates and dairy protein. So parents talk to each other, and they're fairly knowledgeable and seek these services out because they realize how different their kids are and how socially isolating having a child that eats two foods is every time you go to some kid's birthday party. Right. They're eating pizza and cake, and your kid wants nothing to do with it.
Right. Is there anything that you should, you know, I guess the final thing to ask is, like, is there anything that you should have parents or friends to look for warning signs that it's just beyond a picky eater status?
Okay, so we're looking at kids that have under five or six foods. We're looking at kids that will drop a food and not allow it to be reintroduced. Kids like to, I mean, not all kids have a lot of foods that they eat, but we're looking for 30. We're talking about kids that are eating like five foods. They drop foods, they don't reintroduce, and they're gone forever. And then when you try to reintroduce something, they blow it off and they get very nervous. And even if you find yourself as a parent unduly stressed by how little or how small the variety of foods might be, you should seek some help and just get it eliminated as a possibility. Yeah.
And then let's end on a positive note.
Yes.
What can you say to parents who and families that are going through this? You know, what words of encouragement can you give them?
Okay, there is help. Of course, I'm one of the people that you could seek out, but there are other practitioners in the area that could help you with this. But you get in early. If you suspect something's up, don't take the pediatrician's, you know, don't worry as a, you know, a be-all, end-all. Look into it, keep an eye on it, and the earlier we get to it, the easier all of this is, because we, like I say, we don't have these cognitive constructs around why it is that we don't eat. These kids just don't eat because they're you know, have an issue, and we can correct that in fairly, you know, short time.
Awesome. Well, can you give people the nuts and bolts of where they can find you?
Okay.
Website, email, Twitter.
Yep. I'm at Twitter at Brooklyn Feeding and www.brooklynfeedingacademy.com.
Awesome. Adam, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being here. And where can people have a tiki drink from you if they're so inclined?
Yes. Just keep an eye out. I always have some kind of clandestine plans and, you know, hang out at PKNY a good bit, and we'll make that happen.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on Snacky Tunes.
Thank you, sir.
Coming up next, we have Freelance Whales live in studio. We're going to play a couple tracks off of the Snacky Tunes Live Volume 3, which is out now for free streaming and download. You just need to go to Heritage Radio Network SoundCloud page or just Google those things, and we will be up there. These are tracks from Moon Hooch and Erica Spring, who both played the release party two Tuesdays ago, and it was great. Freelance Whales live in studio next, and shout out to Darren. I know you're out there listening.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Amazing. Freelance Wells, welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I think it's, we're trying to figure out maybe 2.5 years, 2 years. Long time.
That sounds about right.
Sounds about right. Just, you know, for anyone who didn't go back and listen to the episode, put a pause in this one and go back. You guys were the reason why we started making those Snacky Tune comps. It was after, yeah, it was after your performance. We were like, well, shoot, that went really well. And this sounds good. And then we realized that we had like 8 other performances. And like, oh, I think we could actually make something of this. So, you know, thanks.
That's awesome.
So how you been?
The whole second record.
We've been good.
The whole second record was inspired by Snacky Tunes.
Oh, get out of here! Come on, I'm telling facts here.
It was an equal exchange.
So how you been?
It's been good. Nice.
So we were saying that the last time when you were here was before your first real major tour, and probably one of the last few busking gigs that you did on that subway platform. So, you know, a couple tours, maybe a Starbucks commercial, and a new record. So you pick. Where do you want to start?
Man, well, it's been a lot more than that. I think it's been like 12 tours.
Okay.
And yeah, like a bunch in North America, a bunch in Europe, and yeah, I mean, things have really changed for us, but in another way, it feels like really normal and good to be sitting right here doing this kind of thing back at home. So I think a lot of things have changed for us in a really good way.
What are some of the changes?
Man, I think like just, I don't think we've changed much as people, but I think the scenario around us is like a lot more professional, I guess. Like we just, for the first time on this past tour, we were able to like carry a lot of our own production and stuff like that. And we were able to, you know, kind of like just these little things that people might not notice. Like we had inner ear monitors,
that's
which are these little things that go in your ears so you can hear your music really well. It was the first time we could really hear our music well on tour. Like it's been really difficult. I think part of what's been so difficult being in this band is like loving music so much, but constantly being in situations where it's difficult to execute your music well. So we're getting to a point where we can do it better.
Give an example of where it was difficult to execute your music.
Oh man, well, all the places in the city that we love playing music and we think are great places and we want to go see bands. You know, I don't want to like call any of them out, but
that's fine.
You know, like when we're first starting and we're like playing like Spike Hill or Trash Bar or something like that, mm-hmm. or even a place like as awesome as Pianos or something, it's really like hard from our standpoint to get up there and have it.
Yeah,
sound.
We have standards now.
Yeah, yeah, that's the main difference.
And
not to knock Pianos or things, but those are starting out bars. Like that's where you start out. And you know exactly what you're gonna get, and like that, you know. And I love all those bars for the reasons what they are, but you're not expecting it to be. You're almost like you're like, well, what could this be? This is like you go there and you're like, well, I get an idea.
Totally.
I mean, I've seen so many bands at, like, I saw St. Vincent was there, Passion Pit was there, like,
totally.
Like, they all played, so many other ones, like, played their opening, and you're like, okay, I see where this could go.
Totally.
And so what is there anything that you feel that, like, you've grown so big that you somewhat miss and you don't think you can return to, or is you're, you know, do you still feel the ability to do whatever you kind of want?
No, I don't think we've grown too big. We're really still, in my opinion, like a pretty small band. But like kind of in that sweet spot of being able to do everything exactly how we want to do it. But I don't think, you know, we haven't shot out into this like really, you know, this really high stratosphere where we can't, like play the kind of shows we want to play, or we can't, make the kind of records we
want to go shopping.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think we're kind of in a sweet spot right now.
You mentioned on the road, you know, just being fans of music lovers. Any bands in the last 2 years you've seen that you want to just shout out as bands that have blown you away?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Foles. We toured with Foles. Yeah.
Oh, that's
in
awesome.
2010. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I feel like I learned everything about how to play a show from Foles, even though it was like our 10th tour or 11th tour on that cycle.
Why is that?
They just bring it. They just bring it so hard.
A lot
hard,
of energy.
You know? And they're so good.
I think we learned something from like every band that we toured with. I mean, certainly like even before that, we toured with Baron Heaven, who are also from Brooklyn.
Great Brooklyn band.
And we learned a lot from them just about like rhythm, like consistent rhythms. And
how to play the drums well.
But think about it, though. We can't really speak too much because we haven't been on tour for a year and a half.
Right.
I mean, we just came back from tour.
We just did a tour.
But I mean, like, before this tour, like, we were recording the record. So, like,
well,
as far as, like, working with bands or, like, being on tour with bands, the only one I can really speak for in the present is, like, Geographer, who we just came on tour with. And
well, in my mind,
pretty awesome.
I haven't really seen you guys since that last one. So we can put all 2.5 years as up for a discussion. Why don't we play another song?
Sure thing.
What's this one called?
This one, let's do Locked Out.
You're doing great. Awesome.
Thank you.
So with the influence of the bands from the last couple of years, has that played at all into the new record, or, you know, how has that, you know,
for sure,
how has that changed your approach to music and putting together the new album?
Well, it's difficult because I think, you know, when you play in a band like this and you're taking in so much of other people's music, and it's so inspiring, especially when you surround yourselves with like great bands like we have, sometimes that influence just kind of comes in passively. And it's sort of like, you know, the food you eat or something like that. You know, you're eating food, you're getting nutrition from it, and it's like literally changing your cells from the inside out. And so I think a lot of the influence that bands had on us kind of happened in that way.
Yeah, for me, I think a lot of the influence was Shane Stumbeck, who we worked with as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And he just brought his style to the record.
Yeah. How so?
Well, he's just a really intelligent dude and has a lot of experience.
He's really intelligent.
Works with some great bands.
And how was the process for putting this record together different than Weather Vanes?
We recorded in a great studio in Brooklyn.
That is really the main
difference.
Opposed
to like a tiny room.
Weather Vanes was done kind of in like a basement with pretty good gear at the end of the day, but really it was done in kind of a modified space for very little money. And this was basically a kind of thing where we were able to like take all of the ideas and instruments that we've accrued and do something in like a much kind of larger format.
Did you bring any new instruments for the record? I mean, you guys already play a lot of instruments. It's kind of busy on stage.
It is. And I think that there is a notion that if we were going to expand, it had to be in kind of small, tasteful ways. So I think the main difference is, whereas like, you know, the first record was done with like a lot of kind of limited use of synthesizers or just very few, you know, most of that record was done with like a microkorg.
Right.
With this record, we just kind of took on a lot more great kind of classic analog synths.
Yeah, we're a sound dude's nightmare.
It's true.
How long a sound check normally?
As long as it can be.
Yeah, as long as physically possible.
So you had to get to headlining status just so you could have the proper sound check.
Exactly.
That was the motivation. No. Exactly. Oh, but it's line check freelance Wales. And I'm like, no, sorry.
Well, I mean, it's shocking how many times we've done that. And who knows how it came out. We don't know. But, I mean, probably pretty bad.
How's the in-ear sound?
It's cool. It's like, it's a big change. You know, like, it means that there's like a lot less we have to do on stage because we just plug it in and it sounds the same every night.
That's great.
It's really awesome.
So, you know, both your albums have been like thematic. One being, you know, a lover chasing. This one seems to be more about outer space.
Sure.
Where do you pull your theme song, you know, or where does that come from as opposed to writing more about everyday life?
I think part of it comes from this very earnest place. And then part of it comes from this very kind of fun, mock, epic, sort of silly place. But the earnestness is that, like, well, I guess, you know, trying to reflect on what's going on kind of in a bigger way in the world right now, it's not that far-fetched that we may have to become spacefaring humans in the somewhat
not so distant future.
Yeah, in the not so distant future. So there's this notion that and the record is a little bit apocalyptic in that way, but I think it's trying to embrace that notion and say, well, hey, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. It wouldn't be the end of the world.
No. Hopefully not.
Yeah, exactly. But so, yeah, so on one level, the record is kind of like about that, and then, but it's also kind of making fun a little bit of that, or this notion that we're all obsessed with that, you know, in less than a month now, or around a month, less than a month, there's going to be some sort of cataclysmic event.
I mean, maybe. Was it supposed to be like 5 or 6 months ago and they just changed the date?
Yeah.
I think from what I've seen, and actually the album artwork is derived from this poster that our friend Vera made, which was a fictional kind of party, a fictional event. And it was called Noah's Ark Party. And the idea was like, oh, it's like a costume party where you come dressed as your favorite animal on December, it's 21st, right?
Right.
December 21st, 2012. And so it's this beautiful poster. It says, like, you know, December 21st, 2012, South Street Seaport, come dressed as your favorite animal, serious costumes only.
Hmm.
And the notion is everyone's going to get on a boat and try to survive.
Hmm.
And that it's this funny poster that we, and it actually became the foundation for what we made our album cover out of for Diluvia.
Well, why don't we hear another track off of it?
Sure thing.
Which one's this?
This one is
called
Aeolus. Yeah.
You got a tune.
There will be a moment of tuning followed by several minutes of the music.
Is that?
Awesome. So before we get to the last song, I just have to ask food highlights from the last 2 years of 12 tours.
Oh my lord.
Let's just get it out there.
Like across the country.
Across the world.
Across the world. Oh man.
Unless we need to narrow it.
What was the question?
We had a back-to-back.
Good food highlights.
Back-to-back on the last tour. We were in Kansas City and then straight to Dallas. So two huge barbecue
amazing
capitals, and we
feel free to shout out any places.
We stopped in Oklahoma Joe's in Kansas City, and then we stopped at Smokin' Joe's
in Oklahoma.
No theme here.
At an RV park.
Yes.
Okay.
And that was like, to me, that was the best barbecue.
There was some rumor that we had heard that there was another place near Smokin' Joe's that opened up called Smoking Joe's to try to take away their business. And they also had, we heard that they
classic
had
classic barbecue misdirection.
They had also, people had tried to make it seem like Smoking Joe's had closed down on Google or something like
that. Oh, wow.
Because it's that good.
it's like
people are trying to sabotage
it. It's so good. And then not let's and worldwide. Any.
Oh man.
What was that place we went to in Paris? It was
L'Alchimiste.
L'Alchimiste.
Yeah, that was a really amazing place.
Yeah.
That was probably the best restaurant I've been to outside of the United States.
We always get really good.
I don't remember too much of the menu, but.
Yeah, that's
I remember a lot of duck.
I remember a lot of drinking, too.
That's fair.
A lot of wine, so.
We always get really good sushi in the Pacific Northwest, like in Vancouver.
Any horse in Vancouver?
Did we eat horse?
Yeah.
No.
We've had people on here who have talked about horse sashimi in Vancouver. Yeah. Oh, we can move on from that topic right now.
No, that's okay. My interest has peaked.
Tim and I had amazing coffee at Phil's in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, so coffee.
Okay. That's
sweet
actually
coffee.
That's amazing.
The best food we've ever eaten at a festival was catered by Chuck Hughes at the Oceaga Festival in Montreal.
Yeah.
They had everything you could ever... They had, like, moule marinière, like a huge thing of steamed mussels. They had kind of, like, unlimited oysters. It was insane. Like, I think we probably...
And all the while, Arcade Fire was sitting right next to us.
Yeah. We probably, between all six of us, probably ate $2,000 worth of oysters. And we still feel awful about it. Sorry, Chuck.
I mean, they're there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, they're just going to get tossed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying.
They're extremely... perishable.
Yeah, it's not like, well, we'll just put them back for next year's festival or anything like that. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming back in. Shout out to Jessica from Mom and Pop for setting this up. And congratulations. I don't even know what to say. Like, awesome. Job well done. Gold stars all around.
Cheers, man.
And
how's your brother doing?
He's good. He's really bummed. He really wanted to be here. You know, he's got a desk job for these 6 months, so... He can't find a way to get onto air without, you know, doing it. But he says, hey, and he's bummed, and he loves all of you. And
well, we love both of you.
Oh, well, thank you guys
so much.
And
we like to think we can tell you apart.
Can you?
Yes.
No. We're going like 50-50 on the room. It's okay. We won't do a live on-air test, but what are you going to take us out with? Oh, first off, sorry. So your publicist and label, Don't Kill Me. Nuts and Bolts, where can they find you? Where can they buy the record? How can they follow you?
Oh, yeah. We have a new record called Diluvia. It came out just like 2 months ago or so, and it's extremely available on the internet, like on iTunes,
Amazon.
It's only $5 on Amazon for the rest of November.
Oh,
hey,
what up, Cyber Monday?
Take that, Black Friday.
Yeah.
Huzzah.
And then website, Twitter, just Freelance Whales.
Oh yeah, we are freelancewhales.com.
And we're going on tour in January.
Oh yeah, 100 Waters.
100 Waters, signed by Skrillex, as you say.
Yes, exactly.
But not dubstep or future dubstep or
not at all.
Okay.
We're going out with 100 Waters and another Brooklyn band called Il Abanico.
Yeah.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. All right, well thank you again. Big thanks to Tiki Adam. We'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. And what are you gonna take us out with?
We're gonna take you out with a song from our first record called Generator Second Floor.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Thanks you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Smell of these wood frames
It's the only sense I've left was so as you pull me from the bed. Tell me I look stunning and get down.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.